the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you being on the show with us this month. If ever you've got a question you'd like to be on this program, email that at any time to news@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. I'm surprised you're not wearing a Dodgers cap when you come in. Congratulations to your Dodgers beating my Cubs this year, a flip-flop of what happened last year.
Thank you for noticing. No, I have my jacket ready to break out for the start of the series. It's been a long time, and for someone who's been a fan of that particular team since he was, I don't know, 5 years old, you can imagine I'm pleased.
Well, let's actually start with a couple of sports topics, in fact. You got to speak at the recent ceremony that the Colts held honoring Peyton Manning. What was that like?
It was fun. It was a great event, and I was very touched when he asked me to be one of the presenters. I mean, there I am with Tony Dungy, Bill Polian, Jeff Saturday, Roger Goodell, and it was quite a moment, and we had a good time doing it, and I was able to reminisce about getting the stadium built, which was a touch and go thing. The city made a deal, if Indianapolis made a deal with the Colts, but they couldn't figure out how to get a stadium built. I didn't talk about it that day, Stan, but when we in the state stepped in, it was my first year in the last job, and when it was about the whole thing was about the collapse, we stepped in and came up with a plan to do it. In truth, it really wasn't all about the Colts. If it had only been a football stadium, I said at the time, we wouldn't have done it.
And the convention center, of course, was a huge part of that.
Yes, because Indianapolis has been so smart to always have its sports stadium downtown and part of the convention center where it can be used for multiple things. And as I recall, fewer than 10% of the events in the stadium are Colts games. It's so versatile, and it's made Indianapolis a major punch above its weight convention city. So that was a fond memory to recall. I mean, on that day, we only focused on the football and the Colts, but that facility has meant an awful lot of jobs. It's meant a lot of dollars coming into the state, and I can remember at some Final Fours, I would stand out on the at halftime, let's say, go out and on the mezzanine, and I'd tell people I was enjoying my favorite spectator sport, which was watching people from out of state spend money in Indiana.
You had a funny line at the end of your speech saying to Peyton that statues of Southerners have had a rough go of it this season, but you didn't figure this one would suffer that same consequence.
I think this one will probably be non-controversial.
Let's talk about something else. You were part of a long interview, a long story with the Indianapolis Star recently, along with the presidents of Butler and IU, talking about the college basketball story recently that's led to Rick Pitino getting fired at Louisville and others losing their jobs at campuses across the country. And largely this is because there's been a too cozy relationship with benefactors, let's just say, to college basketball programs. And one of the interesting things you said in the article was you said you've heard about this behavior from Purdue's program. And I wondered whether you had any inkling of looking at whether there was anything even going back into Purdue that has reminiscences of this.
What I meant is I heard it about other schools from our people.
That's what I figured you meant.
Who have to compete to recruit with places who don't have the same maybe outlook and standards that we do. It is a handicap for those schools who try to be very, very careful and do everything just by the book when other schools don't. When they, it doesn't have to be things quite as terrible as what we've learned about Louisville and these other places, out and out bribery and so forth. You know, phony classes and all sorts of ways to make a mockery of the ideal of the student athlete. But we here, I'll just say, you can't work harder at it than our people do to make sure that we dot every I and that nobody ever colors outside a line. And it does take continual vigilance, I guess. And you have to be careful that someone who's not in your own employed isn't doing something you don't know about that indirectly affects the program. But we've had a great, great squeaky clean record, want to keep it that way. And meanwhile, others are much more casual about it. So I am very glad to see that the FBI has started on this. That might be the one way this thing gets cleaned up. And now the NCAA has asked a really illustrious group, Condi Rice, Father Jenkins from Notre Dame, and others, to make what I hope will be really sweeping recommendations. And but we'll have to see.
Do you think that FBI investigation almost needs to look at all of the programs just to say, look, we've done a comprehensive look and we've tried to get the broadest scope of what this might be as we possibly could?
Well, it's not for me to tell the FBI anything about how to do its business, but I, from having observed the way they do business before, it's very likely this thing will go further. Not every program everywhere, and they don't have the resources, and there's really no need. A lot, most of us, I think, try to do it right. But I think that odds are that there's more here than just four or five schools. And I think that if this thing's ever really going to get disinfected, there's going to have to be a far-ranging inquiry that forces these issues out in the open, where people will say, this really has to change.
Obviously, this is a state where, since time immemorial, it seems like basketball has been the sport that this state cares perhaps most about. And you also talked in the article about trying to find a way to maybe separate high school athletics from the AAU summer programs that do a lot of filtering of the top players into the top programs. And you described it as kind of a unilateral disarmament problem, where it would be hard to get everybody to either start or to agree to the same rules in terms of how they were to get their players or their resources. You said, you know, for every 13 solutions we come up with, there are 12 problems. And I think that's a good characterization of the kind of all the tenets of this problem. Do you think that the investigation by the FBI has a chance at solving some of those problems and making it easier on you, the universities, to come to some solutions?
I doubt the FBI will produce the solutions, but they may produce the situation in which solutions become mandatory. And I hope that maybe the Condi Rice Commission will produce the solutions, but the FBI and the things people are now learning, the suspicions that have been confirmed about the rot in the system may create a climate in which people agree that with imperfections we have to make big changes, that almost any change that they bring would be an improvement over what we have.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. Send your questions at any time to news@wbaa.org or tweet those questions at WBAA News on Twitter. I know we've talked about this in this program before, but there's been sort of an uptick in conversation about it in the last month, and so I wanted to address it at least for a moment or two. You've been sent a couple of letters, or been the subject of letters, by members of what's known as the Campus Anti-Fascist Network, and that's a group of professors that opposes hate speech and discrimination, and they say that you've been falsely equating their stances with both a national, sometimes militant group called Antifa, and with those on the far right who've posted white supremacy posters and put furniture on campus in the shape of a swastika. Do you believe at all that you were a kind of, as they say, painting with too broad a brush?
Of course not. But, you know, we protect as well as we can people's right to opinions, even those we think are fallacious. And we read letters from any of our 2,700 faculty, even from a handful, as in this case, and try to show respect. But no, of course not. In fact, the letter exchange involved here, I didn't take any point of view at all. I simply reported to the original letter writer that I've had to write a lot more letters defending him against people who think that his views are extreme and beyond the pale. So I was simply making that report by way of saying that we're a place that will defend the right of people to speak whatever our own view of the validity of what they say.
I wanted to talk a little bit about that back and forth you've had with this professor, Bill Mullen, who we should say helped found this campus anti-fascist network. Have you had a chance to speak with him in person at all?
When I first got here, yeah.
When you first got the job?
Yeah. I mean, he's been, it's fair to say, constantly and personally critical. It's his right to do that. But, you know, his is a one voice or one of a few. And however much we respect it, we don't confuse it with what I'm convinced is a vast consensus on campus that this is a good place, a tolerant place, and a place that has its values in about the right place in terms of protecting everyone's right to speak.
Would you ever be in a position, do you think, to release the correspondence that you've sent back to people who are critics of Mr. Mullen, who are this, who, you know, release all of it to say, here's what I've gotten in, here's what I've sent back, and let people judge based on that?
I think we've devoted more than enough time to this subject.
Okay. I wanted to talk about something that's been going on in the business community. There's been a lot of talk about Indianapolis and Fishers trying to lure Amazon's new headquarters. That would take about 50,000 jobs along with it to wherever it winds up being. There's been articles in the Washington Post and elsewhere assessing Indianapolis chances against a number of other major American cities. Of course, you helped bring in Amazon distribution centers to the state when you were governor. You've helped bring a couple of centers onto campus here to help kids save money by buying books through Amazon. So you've obviously got connections with this company. Is there anything you can do or have been asked to do to try to help Indy's bid to get HQ2?
I've been asked for advice as someone who spent 10 years with a top priority being to bring new jobs and investment to the state. And I supplied a letter that they can include with their application. That's about it. I don't pretend to any unique relationship or even special one with a company that massive, but I think I do know that they have had a positive experience in Indiana. They understand it's one of the best places to do business. That's why they made all these previous investments here, and I have to believe that Indianapolis Metro will have a lot going for it, being in that business climate and having a growing list of resources to offer a high-tech company like that, including what's now a pretty vibrant IT community. That we know this is, from everything they've said and done, that this will be really primary for Amazon. Is there enough – is there a critical mass of talent in the area that they're interested in? And in a way that wasn't the case 10 or maybe even 5 years ago, Indianapolis is sort of moving into that – realm now, and maybe enough to make it to become a contender.
Obviously, you and a lot of other people have talked in recent years about the problem of brain drain in Indiana, having a lot of talented Hoosiers leave to go elsewhere, to Silicon Valley and plenty of other places. How we've heard from manufacturing jobs that they're having a hard time finding skilled labor for the new high-tech workforce. How do you think that a place like Purdue could factor into that discussion in terms of trying to lure Amazon to say, look, we're trying to build these people as fast as they can graduate?
It's an interesting day to get the question. At the end of this week, I'm giving a speech in San Francisco, and so I've been doing a little bit of catch-up research. California's losing people. First time in the history of the state, the last several years, more people move out than move in. Indiana's gaining people, not as fast as we'd like, but more people move in than move out. And when you factor for the snowbirds, that is people who are exiting the workforce and going where the weather's different or the taxes are even lower or something, we've got a little bit of a positive flow going. And Purdue's a part of that. Best we can tell, something around 15% of our out-of-state students who come here and graduate and our international students who come here and graduate take their first job in Indiana, which is the part we don't notice. We all notice when the bright young woman or man next door goes to college and takes their first job somewhere else, but we we don't have the same visibility on that in migrant. So we want to keep on working on that. And you know what I would tell Amazon is this is a place with room to grow. Physically, because that is to say, room for a very large headquarters, room for the people who will come there to work and live. And so I think they're smart enough to know it's not just it's not about who only about who's in a candidate city now, but who would be there very quickly if they really started hiring thousands of people like they're talking about.
I seem to remember that when you did the opening ribbon cutting of one of the Amazon distribution places on campus, you had alongside you someone from Amazon who was a Purdue grad who was highly placed within the company. Is that correct?
We've got them in all the high-tech companies. And so, yes, there are a lot of Amazon employees and leaders who have Purdue in their background. You could find the exact same thing at Google and Facebook and Microsoft and elsewhere.
I mean, is there a call you can place where they see it's coming from Purdue University?
Well,
from their alma mater?
I'm on call on this, and the same thing has happened in some other cases. The DuPont Dow merger is an example. I'm always, because this was my number one goal in life for a long time, I'm always going to jump to help if somebody thinks I can. But Economic Development Corporation for the state and the public leadership, governor and mayor and so forth, who have to call the plays here. And if they think I can help, I will.
Got about 10 minutes left with Purdue President Mitch Daniels on our monthly conversation with him. Remember, you can always email questions to news@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Shortly after we taped our last show, you received a letter from Democratic Senators Dick Durbin of Illinois and Sherrod Brown of Ohio, which were critical of the practices of Kaplan University, having nothing to do with Purdue, but saying, look, in the past, they had some problems with how Kaplan had done its business, and they were wondering whether Purdue perhaps could take the public university model and make some positive change as they see it to the way Kaplan had done it, and you know, do things such as not force students to sign waivers that say we won't sue the school if we're not happy. What did you make of their letter?
I want to be charitable about it. It was factually wrong from end to end. It's not that it contained factual errors. Almost every fact was wrong. No, Indiana taxpayers will not be exposed. It's a matter of state law. It's not a matter of interpretation. No, Purdue is not responsible for any pre-closing liabilities. There aren't any right now, but if there were to become some, the contract is clear. It's not a matter of interpretation. It's in black and white. Kaplan is not and has not been sued, Kaplan University, by any state or local government. There are other entities, other companies with the name Kaplan as a part of their holding company who've had some other problems, but the one we bought did not. So, you know, somebody stuck a letter in front of them. They're busy people. Let's not hold it against them that nobody around them caught these errors.
Are you saying they were just trying to score political points?
Well, I don't know what their motives are. I think they were probably responding to somebody who has an agenda, someone they have had a relationship with. But you know, I ran the operations of a U.S. senator for a number of years, and people bring things in. They want you to advocate for their cause. You need to be careful to make sure you've been correctly informed and advised before you let fling.
And so in terms of what they're saying about Kaplan is there's another way, I think, to interpret it, which is I think you can say that one of the things that they might be thinking is they agree with you that this is, in fact, a good opportunity to make some positive change in the education space. And clearly, they're not the only ones who have been critical of for-profit colleges. And you and I have talked on this program about the way that the for-profit model and the not-for-profit model like Purdue, you know, have some differences within them. What is your general opinion about that idea of you doing this to be able to say to the for-profit folks, look, there's a different way to do this so that we do everything possible to ensure that nobody gets hurt.
I'm going to start again by saying that Kaplan has the best reputation in their whole sector, and we've been over it and over it.
Well, it's not a well-regarded sector to begin with. Let's be honest.
I'm just saying, and even the critics of the sector have said Kaplan stands apart, like Senator Harkin did. But secondly, that we do intend some changes or some enhancements. I like their so-called Kaplan commitment, which no one else has. You can go for 3 weeks, and if it's not working out, you pay nothing. That's good. We might want to extend. Maybe it ought to be a little longer, for instance. We'll have a very explicit marketing code of conduct to make visible the way in which all that will be approached to make sure that people are fully informed before they sign up and that sort of thing. So there'll be some other ideas like that. You know, for those – you and I have discussed, Dan, to me, results is what matter, and their results are pretty darn good. I mean, if you graduate from Kaplan, the default rate is not much higher than Purdue's, for instance, the student loan default rate. They have data that, frankly, the nonprofits don't about their graduates and how they're doing later on, 2 years out of school, 5 years out of school, and their incomes are going up. So they're getting value for their tuition, and we want to continue all that. I've always said that I thought that what really mattered wasn't whether you paid taxes or not. They do. We don't. But whether, you know, what kind of results you're getting. That said, for people who have some sort of visceral issue about for-profit education, they should be the happiest folks around. We're taking one off the books and making it nonprofit. And making it public, and we're going to operate that to the same standards that we believe we are applying every single day at Purdue University.
There was also a long article in the Washington Post not long ago that I thought was interesting. They brought it up at the most recent Purdue trustees meeting, and in fact, both the trustees and your university legal counsel, Steve Schultz, really. Took to task the reporter. Steve Schultz went so far as to say he felt like he wasted 3 days talking to her. And can you talk to me about your feelings about that article? Because it's one of the bigger national pieces that I think people have been talking about recently about this merger.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was wrong from end to end. And Steve completely demolished it. These same facts I talked about were misstated in that one, in that article. I've got years and years of scar tissue from allegations, occasionally in the media that aren't true or weren't fair, and I let these things roll off a little more. Steve, who's one of the most mild mannered people around, has less experience with that, and he was very frustrated that that when somebody said that day was night and that he couldn't. Get them to accept that they were wrong about that.
How do you suppose we continue to have things like, I mean, the Washington Post, I don't know this particular reporter, but obviously the newspaper, you'd like to think the newspaper of Woodward and Bernstein does its homework. I don't know anything about the reporter or her how she does her job. How do we continue to have this big, what it seems like a fact gap between what you guys are saying and what some others are saying?
Because there is a very, very small – we see this in other contexts that you and I occasionally discuss, even today – a very, very small coterie of people who just don't like the idea. And they are peddling stuff, which if people take the time to examine and vet, they wouldn't – repeat themselves, but some people don't, and so it's not very mysterious.
I wanted to move on to a couple other things in our last few minutes. You've spoken a lot about debt, of course, in your time in this job, both student debt and the federal debt and the problems that it's going to pose for people who are graduating from Purdue. I wanted to get your thoughts, if you wouldn't mind, on the tax reform plan that's now put out by the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some interesting articles saying, look, even fiscal conservatives who in the past have worried a lot about the federal debt seem to be kind of putting that concern aside and saying, let's pass this bill. As someone who has been a prominent antagonist of having such a big federal debt as we do, what are your thoughts?
I think they have to be very, very careful. And I say this, I do believe, and by the way, the organization I'm associated with it, that's the number one voice, I think, about the continuing menace of the federal debt and its intergenerational injustice that it's going to inflict on young people of today. That organization is very pro-tax reform because it knows, and I agree, that we will never make headway against the debt unless the economy grows faster. You cannot cut your way out of a problem as deep as we have now. But it knows equally, and I agree, that there has to be spending reduction associated with this. And in fact, it has to begin – we have to start saving the safety net, which is on autopilot to go over the cliff. I'm talking about Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid.
Entitlement reform, as they say.
Yeah. And so there's no word of that. The president doesn't speak to it. Congress, at least the one version that's over there, doesn't speak to it. So that I agree that criticisms on that front. And also, at least in one of the two versions that's out there, there is some gimmickry that has been part of many past federal budgets, assuming changes that are not – that are left unspecified or making assumptions that are too rosy. And so on all those grounds, I think this the budget and the tax reform it contemplates needs a lot of work. But we should all – really across the whole board, we should all be rooting for a significant simplification of the tax code. We should be rooting for something that makes America – and a magnet for investment, which creates jobs and opportunity and new tax dollars. I mean, the simple fact, Stan, is we need a lot more tax revenue, but you can't get it by squeezing the same lemon just by squeezing the same lemon harder and harder, higher and higher rates. You've got to have a bigger lemon. That is to say, you've got to have a faster growing economy. So, if they would do that and do it in the right way, it would be a great step forward. But what they've got out there now is in need of further attention.
So broadly speaking, in a 15-second answer, pro-tax reform, but not necessarily the way they're talking about it now because it's got debt consequences.
Pro-tax reform, but not that only.
Okay. All right. Well, that is the time we have. Thanks, as always, for your time. We certainly appreciate it, and I will be watching the playoffs along with you.
Hope I'm celebrating in blue next time I see you.
All right, sounds good. Well, this has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Remember that if at any time you'd like to send a question for President Daniels to answer on this program, please email that to news@wbaa.org. You can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. And remember, you can find versions of all of these shows archived at our website. That's wbaa.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for listening today on this Indiana Public Broadcasting station. We'll catch you next month.
Major support for the monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Gaylor Electric. Gaylor provides electrical services from pre-construction design through project completion and a 24/7 service department. Information at gaylor.com.